This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Welcome to the People Speak Radio Show. I'm your host, Elizabeth Valencia. Happy to be back. The People Speak normally airs every other Sunday, 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific, 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network Station 1. You can participate during the show with call-in questions for our guests toll-free in the U.S. and Canada by calling 888-627-6008. And tonight, we have a special show. Our guest is Umeyma Mohammed, talking to us tonight about all sorts of different things on Islamophobia and Palestine and Palestinian rights and its connection to police brutality in the United States. Let me quickly introduce her. Umeyma Mohammed is a senior at IUPUI, that's Indiana University, Purdue University of Indianapolis, double majoring in neuroscience and political science. She is an organizer and focuses on countering Islamophobia and the liberation of Palestine, among other anti-racist work. And she's a co-founder of the Muslim Youth Collective, an organization that trains young Muslims to be leaders in the resistance against Islamophobia, racism, and all forms of oppression. She serves for the American Friends Service Committee, which is a Quaker organization that promotes lasting peace with justice as a practical expression of faith in action. She works to address these cultural stereotypes and produces workshops that help participants acknowledge that racism and Islamophobia are real, and different ways to address it. So Umeyma, welcome to our show.
Thank you so much, Elizabeth. It's really an honor, actually, to be here. So
yeah, and I'll tell you that the producer has been so excited to get somebody on the show to actually have a conversation that touches upon Palestine and Palestinian rights. And so I'm really excited to open it up and see where we can take it. So let's start by you telling me and the audience about your life growing up, the spiritual and the sacred, the profane and mundane in your life that has brought you to where you are now.
Absolutely. It's not the most exciting story, but so I was born in South Dakota, actually. I was born in Sioux Falls, which is a really interesting place for an Egyptian-Palestinian person to be born. And I grew up in Texas and Southern Virginia, which is also a very interesting experience for like a young Muslim girl who eventually put on hijab. And there are actually a few defining moments in my life that kind of led me to be doing and to be so invested really in the work that I do now every day. And a few of them, I think maybe the first moment was, I think a lot of Muslim parents kind of raise Muslim kids this way, and, you know, in kids who kind of were raised after 9/11 in a really, really like protective parenting style. And so the middle school that I went to, I was the only Muslim, maybe there was one other Muslim person in my entire school, and I had put on hijab in 7th grade. And this was a really defining moment for me. I went into English class, and our teacher was like, today, you know, we're going to be doing some readings about 9/11, and the only hijabi Muslim Arab person, and like the whole school is like, what's 9/11? And so I think that moment, in kind of learning, like it was the first moment where I learned that there was something unique about being Muslim in America, that there was something like I needed to know, that there was something I needed to be aware of, being Muslim in America. And ever since that moment, I realized that my parents, in attempting to, you know, protect me, like, really left a lot about our history and our experiences and their lives, you know, kind of out of my life, because they didn't want me to bear the same burdens that they had, that they bear in this country as immigrants, as Palestinians and Egyptians. And so when I get to high school, my freshman year, I had a project, and I just decided to do it on Palestine, which I really knew nothing about. I didn't know anything about, you know, my mom was born in Hawara, is a village right out of Nablus, in the West Bank of Palestine, and she never told me anything about her life. She didn't tell any of us about it. And so when I got to high school and I began, and she still wouldn't really tell me when I asked. And so I began to do research in high school about it. And that was a really, it was actually kind of, it was, I don't really know how to describe, like, being like a Palestinian Muslim and then realizing that you didn't really know that until you were like 14 years old, was kind of monumental. It had defined like my entire high school career. And I like remember doing that project and sobbing through the whole presentation, and I got a C- actually because of that, because I was so like traumatized by the fact that I knew nothing of my history or my mom's experience or what my people were going through. And so ever since then, it was just like, I wake up like every day with that goal of like, today, like, we are going to work to like liberate the people of the oppressed. Like, that is the kind of like my historical background on that.
Thank you for sharing that. And that is very profound. I relate to, you know, I became Muslim actually at the age of 14, and I've been on a religious journey myself. And it was actually after 9/11 that I started to cover my head with the headscarf, the hijab, in ninth grade, 14. And as I shared with you offline, my son, who's 14, is doing a project on Palestine, and he's Mexican and Palestinian. So I see that sort of awakening and connecting that you just described in him. And it is very profound. There are tears and there is anger and there is this push to want to get to work. So you shared, though, that your parents didn't want you to carry these burdens, you know, as immigrants, as Palestinians and Egyptians. Would you say that you're carrying those burdens now?
So I think that this narrative kind of carries in a lot of social justice circles that it is both a burden, but also like a sense of liberation to recognize your history and say that, like, today I will not tolerate the, you know, oppression or the targeting or surveillance of my people. So as exhausting as it is, there is like no other alternative, I think, because I find a way to be like, my existence is so tied to this feeling every single day that today, you know, I will do this work. So I think that there's just like no other way to be for a lot of people in this work, because it's like a way every single day. It is like a success to say that today I did this work. Today I did this work, regardless of the burdens, regardless of the burnout and the exhaustion. Today I did this work, and this is self-liberation in the face of systems that don't want us to feel that way.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people who are doing this work would agree with you. And how does your family feel now that you're engaged in this about what you're doing? Or what was it actually like for them to see you first when you first started to engage with it?
So I mentioned that my parents were very protective of us. You know, they never told us about 9/11, which was, you know, a pretty big deal, not to tell your Muslim kids growing up in this house, but that was a thing that they should be aware of. And, you know, they never really told us their stories of immigration or their stories from home, you know. And so when I first started doing this work, for years, this was a point of contention between me and my parents, because they were so afraid for me. You know, they literally, you know, my mom put it this way, is that they literally came here to, like, escape from these stories and burdens, and they didn't want us to carry them. And so when, you know, they saw that I was going, I was participating in rallies on Palestine. I was giving presentations in school about it. I was talking about the occupation. They were terrified. They were really upset. You know, they wanted me to focus on my career goals and my grades, and they thought that this was not only a waste of time, but also like putting a target on my back as a Muslim, you know, woman who wears hijab. And so it was difficult, actually. It was a difficult journey with me and my family, between, you know, talking about like, how can we, and I think that there's a lot of like internalized pain for them too, right? So like people have been targeted as Muslims and as Arab people by the U.S. government and surveillance, and seeing, you know, their daughter begin to uncover these things, I think it was difficult for them as well.
And I was going to ask you, why is it so scary? And you just touched upon some of that, right? The internalized pain of being targeted. But why else is it so scary to do this work?
There's a couple of reasons, I think, why it's scary. And there's a validation, I think, in the fear because of the lived experiences of people of color and Muslims in this country. I mean, the fear comes from, like, knowing that even before 9/11, and especially after 9/11, though, I mean, people are out in public targeting Muslim people with hate crimes or, like, physical assault, literally, you know, policies, you know, over a decade after 9/11 that we call the Muslim ban, right, that, like, puts a ban on Muslim immigration into the nation. The fear comes out of, like, a valid reason of, like, systematic targeting of Muslim people, right? So Muslim people being deported. Now we're seeing Muslim people being denaturalized, Muslim people being attacked, women getting their hijabs ripped off or being kicked in the belly, you know. Mosques are being defamed, and people are, like, literally, I think just a few days ago, maybe last week, the president of a university, I think it was Liberty University in Virginia, literally said to the student body, like, it's okay to carry guns if you're going to go out and kill Muslim people with it. And so I think the fear, and it's not funny, right? I think it's terrifying. And our parents, that generation before us, like, really lived this fear firsthand as adults in 9/11, trying to raise, you know, their kids after this age.
Yeah, and we want to think that things are much better than they actually are in this country. And I know a lot of people don't believe that these things happen, even if they see it on the news, even if it doesn't make it to the media. And I can tell you that when my oldest son decided that he was really going to identify as Palestinian, I got scared. And this is the scariest part of any of the work that I do, like talking about Palestine. But yeah, seeing it in my own child, it is really scary. Yeah. And I've been through wearing the hijab, the headscarf, and having some of the physical attacks and a lot of verbal attacks. And so we know that it is really real. Thank you for sharing that. And for those listening in, this is The People Speak, and I am Elizabeth Valencia, your host, talking to our guest, Umaima Mohammed, who is a community organizer and activist on issues about Islamophobia and oppression and Palestinian rights. So, in the work that you've been doing, Umaima, what are some of the biggest myths that you think are bringing damage to the Muslim community and people of color?
So the biggest myth, I do think, and this is really, this is a myth that was used historically and is used today against all people of color, is, you know, the myth that Muslims are terrorists, right? And that people of color are these, like, violent, barbaric, you know, backwards people, specifically, you know, Muslims. And, like, we know actually that this myth is a manufactured myth, right? So this did not come out of the own public Silicon Mind, right? Even after 9/11, we see something that we call Islamophobic industry, is that there are people who are like paid by organizations, millions of dollars, funded by millions of dollars to create, you know, literature, books, media, documentaries, you know, that reinforce and solidify these myths about Muslims and communities of color. And of course, these myths, you know, they're intentionally manufactured because they're of use, right, to the country, right? So when you justify that Muslims are terrorists, right, we are backwards, that people of color, that people in Africa and the Middle East, right, are these barbaric, backwards people, it makes it very easy to justify, right, military efforts over there, right? It makes it very easy to justify, you know, body counts over there, if you even count the amount of bodies that the military or the government left over, right, when, you know, the U.S. military goes in and occupies Iraq, for instance. So these myths that come out are so difficult to resist because they are so ingrained in society. Because they're intentionally manufactured and they're intentionally made to exist for really the U.S. empire to benefit and to do what it wants to do.
And that's a pretty big one. And I know that whenever there's some awful thing that happens, whether in the United States, North America, or in the world, that we're, you know, even we as Muslims, we jump and really hope and pray that it's nobody that has a, you know, Arabic sounding name, or is from some, you know, the Middle East in any way, shape, or form, even if they're Christian. Like, we don't want it.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we hope and we pray, right? Because we know that it's really real. And I want to say, like, even my mind, it's so, like, I've internalized it so much that my own mind goes there, that it's like, oh, you know. So what do we do? Like, how do we resist this big myth?
Absolutely. So that's something actually I work on with American Friends Service Committee, or AFSC, a Quaker Peace and Justice organization, with a project that they launched almost 2 years ago, called Communities Against Islamophobia. And we've kind of identified, like, what are the ways that we can resist these myths against Muslims. And one way that I found pretty effective in the trainings I've done in the past year and a half, both with the community of allies and Muslims, is to kind of uncover the idea that this is a manufactured process, that these myths against Muslims and people of color, like I mentioned earlier, didn't just like come out of the age after 9/11. But these are old Orientalist myths that were used really from the beginning of white empire, from the Roman Empire, as a way to justify, you know, the occupation and military expeditions into what they call the Orient, right? The brown nations, the Muslim countries, the black countries. And so I think coming from it, actually from that approach, is that, like, and kind of challenging people, right, asking them questions like, why do you think that, right? Why do you believe that myth? And then if they say something like, oh, well, I've heard it on the media, right? And it's like, okay, so what, you know, what makes someone a terrorist, right? Killing innocent people, maybe they say, you know, and then pushing them further, and then challenging them about their bodies, right? So what about the U.S. military, right, who does the same thing? You know, why do we have a different name for that? So I think there's a lot of different approaches actually for you to resist it, and it, you have to have a lot of patience as well, right? Because these people have been fed this kind of information. So how do we unlearn? How do we get people to unlearn these myths and kind of take a journey with us, right? By giving them a kind of analysis, like, okay, if these myths are manufactured, maybe we should be asking why, right? Why do you believe that, right? Who benefits from you believing that Muslims and people of color are terrorists?
I actually wrote that down, because me asking you that question is like coming out of my like despair. So I know that it takes a lot of patience to do that sort of thing, and it's hard, but I guess if anything, it, you know, change takes time. I want to ask you more though about myths, and now I want to really connect it to Palestine, because I do want a second part of the show to, you know, to show the connection with other forms of oppression. But what are some of the biggest myths that we have about Palestine right now?
So something I love about the work that people do in social justice is that it's so interconnected. So we can't really talk about Palestine without also talking about Islamophobia, because one of the biggest myths I think that I see around Palestine is that, well, Israel is defending itself against these barbaric Arab people who are all terrorists, right? Which is really the same myth used against Muslims, which is also a very similar myth used against Black communities here in the United States as well, right? People of color. And so that's very difficult, I think, especially in Palestine, right? Which the narrative that Palestinians are suicide bombers and terrorists existed just as it did for Muslims, really, before 9/11, but it was very profound in media and culture, you know, because the U.S. and Israel have been allies since the beginning, right, since 1948. You know, the media creating this picture of the Palestinian terrorist, the Palestinian suicide bomber, right, who kills these innocent white Jewish people is one of the most deeply ingrained stereotypes and myths about Palestine in America. Right. And so people are always saying, well, Israel is just defending itself. You know, Israel is just trying to live peacefully, but the Palestinians won't let them. You know, all the arguments about Palestine kind of stem from this central myth, which, of course, is a myth that comes out of white empire and white supremacy used against so many communities.
What is there to gain from pushing this myth?
You mean pushing the myth that Palestinians are terrorists?
Yeah.
So there's there's always a couple of ways to talk about this, but the thing to gain here is that we are expanding white empire, right? We are expanding white supremacy. We are outsourcing white supremacy, right? So both America, Israel, and the West has everything to gain from the existence of Israel justifying its existence based on the barbaricness and backwardness of the Palestinians, right? So America gets to expand its Western influence, right, into the Middle East area, right, by declaring Israel as the only democracy, and et cetera, which, of course, Israel is an ethno-national state. But it really goes back to the very first Roman Empire wanting to expand white empire. You know, what's happening is the same, right? We see Western hegemony. White hegemony still exists. I'm tying it back to the occupation of Iraq and military expeditions into Africa and the Middle East over the past several decades by America. And so that's what it has to gain. All Western empire has to gain from the myth of the Muslim or the Arab or the Palestinian terrorist, because it justifies any military expedition, all imperialism, colonization of that land, regardless of the cost of it.
And how are you, you mentioned that you can't address the myths behind, Palestine without addressing these things. What is something that we can do to address this particular myth about Palestine? Does it start by having the very basic conversation about Islamophobia? Does it start even further back than that?
So if you don't want to, when you first talk to people about this, you of course don't want to head on give them a discussion about empire. But to me, it's really how do we talk about Palestine, and how can we remember that Palestinians are human? Because something that this myth does is dehumanize Muslim people, it dehumanizes Palestinians. So how can we rehumanize these people, right? How can we rehumanize them? Because if you rehumanize them, right, then this myth seems obsolete. Then you're why do I believe that? These are people as well. And a way I found that's, been pretty effective, actually, is to kind of relate, especially if you're talking to American people, is to kind of relate that America and Israel have a very similar birth story. So Americans all the time I hear, say, if I lived, during the colonial times, I never would have, agreed to slavery or, the genocide of the indigenous people, right? So I think relating the issue back to what they know, right, settler colonialism, what did we do to the First Nation people in America. What did we do to the indigenous people? You know, this is a terrible part of our history that if you bring it up, no one, you know, most people won't be like, oh, well, I do agree with that. Most people will be like, oh, you know, I never thought about it like this. And so relating kind of what Israel is doing to Palestine, which is colonizing it, right? It is not just an occupation, but this is settler colonialism, right? Building white-only, Jewish-only settlements in Palestinian land as a way to push Palestinians out, criminalizing Palestinians, treating them as barbaric, the same thing that American colonizers did to the indigenous people. And making that connection for people really puts into context the myth that we create about Palestinians and what's happening in Palestine, right? If you take it from an angle of this is a colonial expedition by the West, then people will get a fundamental understanding, I think, about the myths and then begin to unlearn that these are myths we have used before against communities of color to, you know, build white supremacy, to build whiteness and white empire.
And this is part of what you're addressing with the AFSC?
Yeah. So at AFSC, I really focus on two things. You know, the Communities Against Islamophobia Project, which, again, we can't talk about. We can never talk exclusively about Islamophobia without Palestine or the other way around. But we also work, you know, we have people focusing on programming around Palestine, and I do that as well here in Indianapolis.
Yeah, and I want us to get to talking about some of that other work that you're doing and some of the steps that you're planning to take forward. So this is a great moment to break. I'm your host, Elizabeth Valencia, and we will be right back with our guest, Umaima Mohammed, to continue discussing Islamophobia and Palestine and how it connects to other forms of oppression. And we'll take any audience questions after this message break.
Hi, I'm Richard Valzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
With over 150 million registered users, Pal Talk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 Pal Talk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining Pal Talk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
This land is your land.
Join us live on The People Speak as guests from various organizations and fields of humanitarian efforts, artistic endeavors, entertainment, and education share their work and strategies which make a difference. Every other Sunday, 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific, 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern, following Senator Michael Brown's Shadow Politics on the BBS Radio Network, Station 1.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
You're listening to The People Speak, and I'm your host, Elizabeth Valencia, and we are back with our guest, Umaima Mohammed, who tonight is talking to us about some of the work that she does as a community organizer and activist centered around the topic of Islamophobia, Palestine, and Palestinian rights. And I'm really excited because I identify as a Mexican with children that are Mexican-Palestinian. And so this is a topic that hits close to home. But I really want to take this further and talk about how important, Umaima, it is to connect the issue of Palestinian rights and some of the things that we have going on in the United States, like police brutality. So how do we, let's get into that. You know, I know a lot of people who, when, you know, are all in for the Black Lives Matter movement and talking about police brutality among, you know, in the Black community, and they can't yet make that connection with Palestine. There might not be an interest. They might not have any knowledge. And sometimes they actually very strongly oppose talking about the topic. How do we start this conversation?
Absolutely. So actually, so Jewish Voice for Peace has this really incredible campaign called Deadly Exchange. And one way that they try to make this connection is by, so their approach is to say, look, if you are, you know, if you care about policing in America, and if you care about the Black Lives Matter movement and heavy militarized police in the United States who are murdering unarmed Black and brown people, then we should know where this police is getting its inspiration from, right? And so Deadly Exchange, you know, has this really incredible, so if anyone is interested, they should go, they should Google Deadly Exchange, Jewish Voice for Peace. But it relates how police in the United States are actually exported to Israel to train under the Israeli Defense Force, which is the military there, under an occupying military to learn tactics and to learn about the weapons that they use to police Palestinians over there, right? So they also kill unarmed Palestinians in the streets, right? Children, adults, women, it doesn't matter. Same as the police here. So the police in the United States are being trained under the IDF, Israeli Defense Force, a militarily occupying force, as a, to learn how to police people of color. So this is a very concrete example about the connection between caring about policing in the United States and police brutality and connecting it to Palestine and what's happening to Palestine because of Israel. So once you make that connection, you're like, okay, the U.S. police, right, get their inspiration about policing and killing people of color from Israel. It's one inspiration, right? We literally want them to learn how to do that over there. Then we can make the connection that, oh, resisting police brutality in the United States also means resisting militarism, right? There's a connection now between the police and Western militarism, Western policing and military. And so once we get there, we say, okay, what is some like core systems that relate why U.S. police officers are murdering unarmed Black and brown people here and Israel is doing the same to Palestinian civilians over there, right? And it all goes back to white supremacy, right? You will never find anyone, hopefully, who's resisting police brutality in the United States that doesn't say that at the root of this is white supremacy. So white supremacy, you know, obviously doesn't only exist in the borders of America, right? It is exported out by Western nations. And America is the leader. America and Israel are the leader of exporting white supremacy. This means, you know, military expeditions abroad in brown and black countries, right? I mean, it means resisting imperialism and colonization. And so I think that, and a lot of actually, you know, black activists, and one of my favorites, Angela Davis, really makes the connection that to resist, you know, racism and anti-blackness in this country, you also have to resist militarism and imperialism and policing and colonization, because at the root of it, white supremacy is doing all of this. And there's no way you can resist police brutality here without understanding the connection that police are being trained under another Western military to learn how to kill people of color.
When I first heard that connection being made, I had my jaw on the floor. And it seems like something that could have been a duh moment, and yet it's so far removed. And we know that because Israel is held as the expert in counterterrorism, and we have so much like bias. A lot of it, you know, I really talk about this, is theological. When you're dealing with a country that is very highly Christian and you know, is following the Bible, where there are stories that have been interpreted to mean that the chosen people are those in Israel. In many ways, that allowance is made. And because Palestinians have been dehumanized, it's very easy to not care. So how do we get to the point where this conversation can happen more and more if we have some of these things getting in the way of us connecting?
I'm really glad you asked that, actually. So one of the biggest obstacles, I think, in doing this work is that, you know, activists who are not only Palestinian, but any activist that's pro-Palestinian, you know, who's fighting for the liberation of the Palestinians, gets called anti-Semitic, right? So when we kind of talk about this religious identity culture, and we talk about you know, and supporting Israel is a very heavily Christian idea as well, as you mentioned. How can we break something that to some people is theological? Like, how can we get there? So just a few months ago, last year, there's a program at IEPY called Social Justice Education, and every year this scholarship group that I was a part of puts on a large program called the Tunnel of Oppression. And this program it's like a 45-minute immersive experience that teaches the campus and the community about six different social issues. And each social issue has 5 minutes, right? So people choose to talk about police brutality, about food deserts, et cetera. So we pick six topics, and each topic, there's some type of performance or some type of video or some type of experience that we share in those 5 minutes to attempt to relay the importance of the issue. So this year, I decided to choose the occupation of Palestine for my topic. So I only had 5 minutes to talk about it, which was, of course, a challenge. But I really focused on some of the conditions of living under occupied Palestine, right? So forget the historical context. What is it like to be Palestinian right now? What is it like to live in occupied Palestinian territory? So the video covered, you know, some of the main things, like the brutality of the Israeli Defense Force and how, you know, the civilian casualties of Palestinians in the past decade due to several wars and assaults by Israel on Palestine and Gaza. And I focused on home demolitions. And lastly, I focused on what we call night raids and the detention of Palestinian children who were under 18. And so the video, you know, we had 4 minutes of video that talks about the conditions of occupation. And then there was a scene in which I actually helped act out, in which we acted out a Palestinian family sleeping in the middle of the night, and the IDF, the Israeli military, you know, barging in and stealing their child in the middle of the night and charging them with throwing stones and then throwing them in military detention. Right. So Israel is the only country to try a child, you know, a person below 18, in military court. And the media has been, the Western media has actually been following the story of Fahad Tamimi, if you know of her. And so I, of course, didn't get to see firsthand the reactions that people had, because I was acting as a Palestinian mother. And so after the scene happens, you know, this Palestinian mother gets up sobbing, you know, talking about the U.S. complicity in all of this, the fact that the U.S. gives billions of dollars of aid to Israel every single year to fund the military and to fund these night raids. And people were telling me, and, you know, after the group goes through the whole program, there's a 10 to 15 minutes that they can all sit in a room and process what they had just seen. And people were telling me stories. My friends who sat in those processing rooms were telling me stories of people saying, I'm a very religious Christian person in my whole life. I've been told that I should support Israel. But like now, how can I do that after seeing that? How can I do that knowing that Israel, you know, literally steals underage children out of Palestinian homes, charges them with something ridiculous like throwing stones at a tank, and tries them in military detention and abuses them in detention? And so one way that's effective is to just show what is the condition of the Palestinians. Forget the historical, you know, forget the religious, to show that what are these civilians, what are these people going through because of occupation, because of settler colonialism? What are their kids going through? And I think just letting people know, because they don't know, right, because they hide it, letting people know that this is the reality of Palestinian children. This is the reality of Palestinians. They get stolen in the middle of the night and being thrown in military detention is a way to kind of break through some of these very deeply ingrained myths about Israel and deeply ingrained support, blind support for this nation.
It's heartbreaking. And hearing you talking about it is, you know, I'm feeling it. And I'm hoping that anybody who's listening in right now felt that. And I think it's really important to show that in different art forms. And I know there was that, there's, you know, a lashback that happened because of doing that. Are you called anti-Semitic for showing people that these things are happening?
Unfortunately, yeah, actually, I am. And, you know, I mentioned briefly earlier that one of the biggest obstacles for organizing around Palestine is being called anti-Semitic or a Jew hater or, you know, anything that's defamatory around, you know, this subject. And because another huge myth kind of surrounding Israel is this, I don't really know that there's probably a lot of factors, whether it's like Western guilt for the Holocaust, you know, kind of how deeply ingrained actually the Holocaust is in Western history, the fact that the Holocaust was, you know, the fact that millions of mostly, you know, white Jewish people were killed in concentration camps was the reason for the international human rights regime to even emerge, right? So the Holocaust is a very defining moment in Western history. And so when you ever, and Israel, you know, talks about itself as this place where that will never happen again, right? All the Jews in the world can come here and live safely, you know, away from anything like that happening again. So when you, you know, criticize Israel, when you point out clear and documented human rights abuses of Israel on Palestinians, and now, of course, you know, they're paying African immigrants to leave their nation, when we criticize Israel, I think people, since they don't know a lot about it, the first thing that comes out of the mouth is that this is anti-Semitic. And you also have a very organized, very strong pro-Israeli lobby in the United States and very strong pro-Israeli Jewish communities in the United States. And so there was a lot of pushback for that room that I did, for that performance that I did. I was called anti-Semitic by people who are my scholarship mentors, and someone who's actually my professor now. You know, these are professors who are calling students defamatory things like Jew haters and anti-Semitic for being pro-Palestinian or for exposing human rights abuses of Israel, which makes it very difficult then for Palestinian students to continue activism on campus, especially, or activism in their communities, because they're targeted.
Which just makes it even more important, right, to be patient as you're doing the work, because there's all these little barriers that just continue to make it bigger and bigger. And hey, Umeima, I have a caller on line 5. Caller, will you give us your first name, your location, and your question or your comment for our guest tonight?
Hi, thank you very much. This is Mike in California. And Uma, I want to thank you for being on the show.
Thank you so much.
Yes. You know, I compare what happened on 9/11 to what happened when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. People of Japanese descent in America, Japanese Americans, probably felt like crawling into a hole because, you know, it put all the focus on them. There was a lot of anti-Asian sentiment in the country already, but when Pearl Harbor attacked, I mean, it was splashed across the pages, Japs attack Pearl Harbor. I mean, Japs is a slur. When 9/11 occurred and they assigned, you know, the blame to Islamic terrorists, how did you feel as a Muslim in the United States, and were you Muslim at that time?
So thank you so much for your question. Actually, I think that's a very beautiful comparison that you just made. I think that those two go very hand in hand, you know, when kind of talking about the situation of Muslim people today and kind of looking at these trends of targeting communities of color as trends, right, not as isolated incidences, but things that have happened before. So when 9/11 happened, I was actually only 5 years old. And I was born into a Muslim family, so I've been Muslim my whole life. And so thank you for your question, actually. So that kind of goes back to the story that I shared earlier where my parents, you know, really protected us from knowing about, you know, the condition of Muslim people in the United States. They're targeted, that there are, you know, both federal and state policies that target Muslim communities. So when I learned that 9/11 happened, which was in middle school, I was horrified, I think, just like the rest of the nation was at the time.
but it also made me very aware of what did it mean now for me to be Muslim. I wasn't just another normal American kid, right? Now I was a Muslim kid, which meant something to other people, something negative. And I think my awareness of that, like, led me to carry a kind of burden most of my life, and not knowing really what to do with that burden until I began doing, you know, social justice-based work.
So your way of dealing with it was to become an activist.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Do you still feel targeted or like you're under the, you know, suspect?
So I think that, so I do, actually, and I think that also has to do with the fact that I'm very open about organizing against Islamophobia, which is a term that we kind of use as a general term to kind of talk about the fear and targeting of Muslim people and Muslim communities. And there's actually some really interesting statistics by the Pew Research Center that kind of document how a large percent of Muslim people, and I think they did this study only 2 years ago, feel surveilled, feel targeted. And if you even talk to, like, your local imams at the mosque and talk to them kind of about what is their sentiment with the state, right? What are your experiences with the police and the FBI? Most of them, if not all, have experiences with the FBI coming to them and openly telling them, you know, we have informants in your mosque and in your communities. We're not going to tell you who, but we would love to work together. So I think that, you know, feeling like a targeted Muslim person is something that actually comes with the culture of being Muslim here because of federal policies, you know, like the Muslim ban or all these anti-Sharia law bills, which of course mean like absolutely nothing, but are obvious attempts at targeting Muslims at the state level. So you know, these programs that are supposed to counter terrorism, right, in quotations, called countering violent extremism, that literally gives people money and train them to somehow identify early signs of radicalism in Muslim people, which is really only a way to justify the surveillance and policing of Muslim communities.
Thank you so much for answering. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for your question.
Thank you, Mike.
Bye-bye.
Umeima, we have a few minutes, so I really want to, you know, I want to thank you, and I really want to get to talking about your next step with the Muslim Youth Collective. I know it's super new. Will you tell us about it so that we can, you know, help you promote it?
Absolutely. So the Muslim Youth Collective is a very new organization that I and my colleague and friend and brother, really, Ahmed Abbas, started just a few months ago. And it actually came out of the work that we were doing with the American Friends Service Committee with the Communities Against Islamophobia project. So the Communities Against Islamophobia campaign was an idea that came a little before the first edition of the Muslim ban came down. But we wanted to train allies in identifying and understanding Islamophobia. So after about a year and a half or 2 years of that work, the Muslims working at AFSD on this campaign got together, and we were like, we have realized that we've been giving the tools to fight Islamophobia to allies, but we haven't been extending these same tools to Muslim people. And so the Muslim Youth Collective came out of the idea that we want to give the tools, the resources, the language, and the fundamental understandings of Islamophobia to Muslim communities so that they can be on the front lines resisting it. They can be on the front lines defining the movement, defining the resistance against it. And so I've been talking a lot about, I think, as a trend, you know, this kind of fear that Muslim communities have of speaking up because we know we're being policed and we know we're being surveilled. And so there's a general sense that being Muslim means you need to be quiet in America. For you to survive, you have to be quiet. And one goal of the Muslim Youth Collective is to undo that, right? To let Muslims know that their voices are powerful and their voices are effective and their voices need to be on the front lines resisting Islamophobia and racism. And I think that's really the general goal of the organization.
And then you were sharing with me that part of it is getting youth, you know, you go to different mosques monthly and you visit with youth. What do you talk about with them?
So we kind of talk about various things. So usually when we're jumping around from mosque to mosque in the local areas, you know, introducing the collective and talking about Islamophobia, we start with what is Islamophobia to Muslims? What is your experience with Islamophobia as a Muslim community? Right? Why should we talk about it? Should we or should we not talking about it? And kind of the point of this, to have an in-group conversation with Muslims where Islamophobia cannot enter, right? And some a conversation with Muslims, about how to lead the movement for Muslim people.
No, it sounds wonderful, and I'm really excited to see where that's going. And I know we have an email address where people can send in questions, you know, get more information as you're waiting to put it up. And I want to make sure to get that out. That email address is U-M as in Mary, O-H-A-M-M, A-D as in dog, at AFSC.org. Again, U-M-O-H-A-M-M-A-D at AFSC.org. And I really want to end with a question that my son wants me to ask you, because as I told you, he identifies very strongly and he had all these questions, and we decided we're gonna ask this one. And he wants to know, Umayma, what do you think about Palestinian food?
It is the greatest thing on this earth. What a beautiful question.
What is one of your favorite dishes? Because I know he'll hear this when it gets recorded.
Oh, maklouba. Absolutely.
Yeah, maklouba is one of my favorite too. So how do we translate maklouba to our audience?
Well, it literally means like flipped upside down, something that's flipped upside down. So the dish itself is like this amazing mix of rice and chicken, if that's the meat you choose, you know, fried eggplant, sometimes potatoes and cauliflower. And a good maklouba is always, you know, cooked in a big pot, and then you have to flip it perfectly without a single rice falling out of place so that it keeps the shape of the pot. And that's how you know if a maklouba is good or not, if it keeps, you know, the perfect shape of the pot when you flip it, right? So the dish itself is, you know, called something that is flipped.
Yeah, and I have one child who's vegetarian, pescatarian, so I've made it before when I just didn't have any, you know, any meat, with just the cauliflower and the vegetables, and it's really, really good.
Oh, it sounds amazing. I would love to try it.
Yeah, no. I'm so excited, Umayma. Thank you for being a part of this show tonight and for really taking a very different perspective in addressing this conversation. You have, you know, given us great connections, a great base to work from, and I really, really wish you the best with the Muslim Youth Collective here in Indianapolis. Are you hoping that this goes national?
Yeah, actually, I think in Chicago, some of the Muslim people who are originally on the Communities Against Islamophobia campaign are trying to adopt something similar, and this is definitely not even a new idea. We've drawn a lot of inspiration from the Young Muslim Collective, which is a Muslim-based organization in Minneapolis that's led predominantly by Somali Muslim youth who have actively resisted surveillance and in the city very successfully, actually. And so this is not even a new phenomenon. I think youth of color have been organizing for decades, like since ever, really. And so we're only trying to establish something like that in Indianapolis.
Yeah, no, it's a wonderful initiative here, and I'm really excited to follow it. So thank you again. And to all of our audience, you've been listening to The People Speak with your host, Elizabeth Valencia. I'd like to thank you again, Umayma Muhammad, and to remind our audience that you can follow the upcoming launch of the Muslim Youth Collective, and you can get in touch by writing again to UMOHAMMAD. At AFSC.org. Thank you, Mima.
Thank you so much, Elizabeth. Thank you so much for the great conversation.
My pleasure. And thank you all for listening and participating tonight. Have a great night.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.